Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Just one guest up today, Greg Grandin, who is a professor of history, Latin American history at NYU. We'll be taking a broad political tour of developments in the southern part of this hemisphere, which look to be somewhere between encouraging and inspiring. Before that, a few words in the economic news, which is anything but encouraging or inspiring. The recent trend of disappointing statistical releases continues. Not only was last week's employment report a bummer, most subsequent numbers have been soft as well. The ISM Services Index, a survey of corporate purchasing managers, the people who buy things for their firms and are presumed to have a good sense of the state of business, reversed only a small portion of its sharp declines in March and April. It's still at a level consistent with expansion in the service sector, but just barely. New applications for unemployment insurance, which had been in a downtrend through February, rose slightly last week and remain rather elevated, not at collapse levels, but definitely in the sluggish job market zone. Consumer spending also seems to be slowing down, which isn't surprising because everyone who isn't an investment banker or venture capitalist seems to be broke. In the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, which forecasts turns in the economy several months out, has been weakening for the last couple of months. As I said before, I don't think these are signs of a relapse of recession, but rather exactly what you'd expect in a post-financial crisis recovery, a very long period of intense crappiness that barely feels to anyone like an upturn. The economy needs more stimulus, but that's not the way our leaders have been talking. Perhaps if Anthony Weiner had tweeted that message, perhaps via a tattoo, we might be having a different conversation. But the word stimulus probably would have been misinterpreted in that context. And now, a couple of audio excerpts from a meeting I attended at the Council on Foreign Relations on June 7th. I'm not a member, but I'm just on their media list. I find their public sessions very interesting, a way to eavesdrop on the thinking of the more intelligent branch of our ruling elite. Their off-the-record private sessions for members only are probably even more interesting, but I'm not invited to those. I should say that I'm playing these with the kind permission of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the copyright belongs to them. This meeting was one of their quarterly economic roundups. The pundits were Vincent Reinhardt, who spent many years as a staffer at the Federal Reserve in Washington, and who is now a fellow at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, and Matthew Slaughter, who is an economic advisor to George Bush and is now dean of the Dartmouth Business School. Of the two, Reinhardt was the more interesting. Here, for example, is what he had to say about the possible resolution of the Greek crisis.
I'm David Byme from Columbia Business School. Could you specify what, in your opinion, is the most probable outcome of the Greek debt crisis? It's not foreseeable, but of all the possible futures there might be, which is the most probable in your view? There seems to be an irresistible force and an immovable object.
Vince? So
I get to give my second favorite empirical regularity in the book. If you look at the history of the empire and the Commonwealth, you see that there are very few debt defaults. And political scientists have written papers about how maybe that's religion, Napoleonic code versus common law, distance from the equator. But here's the regularity. There are a whole lot of restructurings. Yeah. For most of history, default is an event. The strong declare on the weak when they lose their patience. And if you're in the members of the same club, you're less likely to lose your patience. Hence, you restructure rather than default. Greece is in the club. As long as the political problems of where the voters are relative to the elite at the top and the bottom don't intrude, that suggests that you get some form of restructuring, some form of extension of terms unfavorable to the investor, both in terms of maturity and coupon, in a way to buy enough space that the fiscal transfers are large enough to put Greece on a more sustainable path. part of that will also be buybacks. You buy the debt at default at very low prices, and you give it back to the issuer at even lower prices, and then you share the losses. Here's Jean-Claude Trichet's great fear. The easiest mechanism currently in existence in the continent is the ECB. They can buy under the table. They can buy in markets. They can buy them at buy Greek debt at very depressed prices and swap it back for some other security that's even less favorable terms. So I think the likelihood is you mark down the terms of existing debt. You do it because you've already encouraged your financial institutions to hold that debt, and you remind them that their continuing existence depends on the attitude of the government. You have investors take that loss, and then you have a press conference and say, the European experiment is ongoing. We're able to absorb this without default, without a change in membership.
Note that Reinhardt's outline is actually far more reasonable than anything the European elite now seems capable of coming up with. And here's what Reinhardt had to say about our current political situation.
When it comes to economic policymaking, we can write down a list of the optimal policies for monetary and fiscal policy, for reg reform, for in the international domain. But that gets put in place by a political system. And it's a political system in which the voters are unhappy. They've had a decade of poor performance for the median household.
Right.
They've seen income inequality get worse. And then they've seen a financial crisis in which they hear too big to fail, which they interpret as I'm too little to help. The system seems unfair. How are you going to generate the consensus to make aggressive policymaking that allows you to take care of the near-term softness in the economy and address the longer-term structural problems? The answer is we may not be able to deliver that sort of thing. And to the extent that we let our focus on the next two quarters' worth of growth distract us from longer-term responsibilities, we may, in fact, just be making the cost of dealing with them ultimately, which we'll have to, all that higher.
Dealing with them, what's the them? Sorry, explain.
Large budget deficits, an unsustainable path for fiscal policy, longer-term productivity, and our ability to increase incomes for the median household, our place in a world economy in which we're not going to be as important. There are some serious longer-term issues that we have to come to grips with.
That was the voice of Vincent Reinhardt at a meeting of the Council on Foreign Relations on the morning of June 7th. The guy asking for clarification was the moderator, Sebastian Malaby. Thanks to the Council for the permission to play their audio. You can get full audio, video, and transcript at cfr.org. There's a lot in that passage, but embedded in it is the orthodox assumption that deficit cutting is the best way to assure long-term growth, and the best way to deficit cutting involves cutting entitlements, as they like to say, meaning Social Security and Medicare. So the political trick is that a population that feels screwed must nonetheless be persuaded to accept an austerity program. I'd like to have Reinhardt on the show to discuss all that. Back after a musical break.
Everybody's so in love.
That was a bit of the Mekons doing Millionaire. My only guest today is Greg Grandin. Greg teaches Latin American history at NYU and is the author of Empire's Workshop, a book about how the U.S. learned the imperial trade through its adventures south of the Rio Grande, and also Fordlandia, about Henry Ford's giant scheme to build a factory in the jungles of Brazil. Lots of interesting things have been going on in Latin America, and Greg is the perfect guy to talk about them. Greg Grandin. So, Greg, it's been a while since we did our political tour of Latin America. It's time for an update. There seems to be quite an arc of pinkitude developing in Latin America these days. Of course, the most recent results from Peru. What happened there?
Yeah, well, just there was a runoff election this Sunday, it passed, it was between the daughter of Alberto Fujimori, who's in jail on a number of different crimes. He governed Peru between 1990 and 2000, and a center-left nationalist, Ollanta Humala, who ran in 2006 and came pretty close to winning, but then there was a big scare, and WikiLeaks reveals that the U.S. Embassy was mobilized by establishment politicians to paint him as a kind of Hugo Chavez in waiting, and he lost that election, and he spent the last 4 years building a coalition, and he, of all of the multiple candidates in the first round, was the only one who offered an alternative to the kind of heavy-duty extraction economy that has been the Peruvian model for quite some time now. And he won. He won with about 2% of the vote.
And now the bourgeois authorities have been going on about what a great boom has been going on in Peru in recent years. Certainly the commodity bubble probably been pretty good to Peru. But I gather the wealth from those statistics is not trickling down.
Yeah, it's classic kind of rentier stuff. It's mostly mining, minerals, gold, tin, copper, nickel. About 60% of Peru's GDP exports are mineral exports. And yeah, over the last couple of years, there's been about 7% on average growth and low inflation, currency reserves. You know, all of the things that make Peru a kind of model economy for the credit default swap types and the bond markets. But it didn't trickle down, and didn't trickle down in very noticeable ways. The kind of profits skimmed off of the export financed this building boom in Lima, where a large percentage of the population live. You go to Lima, you see sky rises, you see malls, you see condos going up. But then you go into the countryside where the vast majority live, and some statistics, I mean, it's hard to pin some of these statistics down, but something, you know, a majority of the rural population, whether it be in the Andean highlands or the Amazonian lowlands, are poor, and some of them are desperately poor, and it translates into ethnic terms. The vast majority of people live in the countryside are either mestizo or Native American, and they live in communities that, you know, haven't seen any of the benefits that Peru has been celebrated for in the last couple of years. And what you actually do see is a lot of disruption of the countryside pushing migrants into the capital. Lima itself is sprawling out. Growth of shanty towns in Lima is quite astonishing. It's growing exponentially.
People leaving the countryside
and into the
looking
cities.
For work.
Yeah, looking for cities.
And it's not there.
And it's not there, and it's an informal economy.
Now, the typical social structure of a resource extraction country is a very thin layer of wealthy people who pocket most of the proceeds, and the rest of the country is afflicted with poverty and toxic waste. Does that fit Peru?
Yeah, and it maps on, as I mentioned, you know, quite in very clear racial terms, where the majority Native American are in the countryside. Lima is middle class, and it's coded white, even though white could be anything from, you know, straight from Andalusia to mestizo or cholo, as they say in Peru.
And now, how do the Japanese fit? Fujimori, there's a substantial majority, right?
Is substantial.
Are they honorary whites?
Yeah, they're honorary whites. Fujimori presided over this enormous, one of the things he's in jail for is corruption and bribery and embezzlement. So this notion that somehow these more negative stereotypes often associated to more darker-skinned people seem to be quite endemic in his administration. But what's interesting is that Humala didn't win Lima at all. His breakdown is very clear. He lost Lima by quite a wide margin. I don't think he only won about 40% of the vote there. So all of his support, his rank and file, comes from the countryside, again, either the Andean highlands or the Amazonian lowlands. And he's the first president that Peru has had in quite a long time, perhaps ever, that is not a president of Lima, that doesn't represent the interests of Lima.
So how will that play out given the social structures of the country? I imagine there's going to be a lot of resistance from the power centers.
Yeah, well, there's different pockets of power. The day after his election, the stock market plunged 12%. Credit default swaps skyrocketed. And somebody told me, I don't know if this is true, I haven't had time to check it, that they actually had to close the stock market in the middle of the day.
They did suspend trading.
That happened.
More than 10%.
And so there's that. There's international capital and all of the pressures along those lines. But then there's just the rank racism and the apparently middle class people from Lima are pulling out their money. There's all sorts of rumors circulating that he is going to lead a race war. That he represents this kind of repressed indigenous resentment that has long simmered in Peru since before independence. A very bifurcated social structure in Peru, where, you know, Peru was a country that doesn't have a lot of this kind of what in Latin America they call a kind of indigenous nationalism, that at least rhetorically imagines the mestizo as the national archetype. In Peru, it's there's Indians and then there's whites, which and within that white category could be anything from the Japanese to the mestizo. So Humala is going to have to confront that. During the campaign, he deflected and he avoided the question as best as he could. But a lot of his supporters came out into the plazas, including Lima's plaza on the night of his election, waving that rainbow flag of indigenous rights that had became popular in Bolivia over the last 10 years.
Now, he does have something of a radical past. He is a member of one of Peru's, Peru's several communist parties. But now he's trying to, as they say, the pundits say, walk back from that. He's trying to present himself more in the Lula model. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, his father was a member of the Communist Party. Not the Communist Party that, I mean, it's very complicated, Peru. I mean,
yeah, there
Peru
several,
was known for sectarianism. And
his father wanted him to pardon the Shining Path.
Yeah, even though his father was a member of the Communist Party, Patria Roja, red fatherland or red homeland, not the Shining Path, the red flag that the Shining Path came out of. And he himself in 2000 led an aborted coup against Fujimori in the last throes of the Fujimori. By that point, it turned into a corrupt dictatorship, and that had a lot of support. And along those lines, people have likened him to Hugo Chavez and Venezuela, because Hugo Chavez did also try to lead a kind of popular uprising against a corrupt partyocracy in Venezuela. And that was very successful in linking him and tainting him and associating him with Venezuela and Chavez in 2006. But it didn't work this time. And part of it was strategic, that Humala went out of his way to model himself on Lula, on the Brazilian Workers' Party and Lula, which is interesting in two ways. One, just symbolically, and I think it's a clear example of how, the kind of what the so-called populist left and the so-called responsible left actually work in nice, and they have a nice symbiotic relationship where the existence of a more threatening populist left all of a sudden makes Lula and trade unionism and the Workers' Party acceptable. Even somebody like Mario Vargas Llosa, who has been this very strong free marketeer, an ideological free marketeer, he wound up endorsing Humala because Humala successfully linked himself to the Brazilian Workers' Party and Lula. On a more substantial...
Well, Vargas Llosa was also afraid of a return of
Fujimori. Yeah, there is a center-right constituency or grouping in Peru that no matter how conservative they are, they were Democrats under Fujimori, and they don't want to see the return of that. So, and I think Vargas Llosa distinguished himself quite well, and compared to somebody like De Soto, Fernando De Soto, right?
Oh, I interviewed him about 10 years ago. Yes.
Yeah, he was a big partisan of Fujimori.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
Because when I interviewed him, he tried to present himself. He said, people in the United States think I'm a right-winger, but that's not the way I'm perceived in Latin America.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And Vargas Llosa, father and son, Alvaro Vargas Llosa, doesn't have the talents of the father, but has the same political passion when it comes to linking free markets with democracy and capitalism with democracy. They both were actually quite good on this question, and they actually even refused to legitimate De Soto by debating him over the merits of Fujimori, Keiko Fujimori. So that was quite an interesting turn. But in terms of substance, what you saw was a lot of Brazilian advisors coming into coming into Peru and actually working with Humala, not just in terms of his substance and rhetoric and style and the platform that he presented, but some people kind of see this as a, saw this election as a proxy between Brazil and the United States over influence in the region. Whereas if Fujimori would have won, she would have tilted more to Canadian mining, to Washington politically, but also Canadian and U.S. mining companies and other resource extraction. Whereas Humala tilts more to Brazilian resource corporations, you know, including Petrobras, which is practically a private organization, even though it's technically public. So you kind of read the election as not so much, you know, it's not just that he was tilting toward Lula rhetorically in order to distance himself from Chavez. There's real substantive ties to Brazilian to Brazilian economic interests, where, you know, trying to pull in Peru into Brazil's kind of increasingly strong center of gravity, particularly when it comes to kind of these economic corporations and these extractive industries.
I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, who teaches Latin American history at NYU. Well, let's talk a bit about Brazil now. Lula is gone now, as a successor, but how would you evaluate the Lula years in Brazil? He was certainly not the radical that some people feared when he took office.
Well, it's always relative, right, how you define it. No, he wasn't the radical when he took office. And again, to compare it to Chavez or Evo Morales, I think it's a completely different situation. Evo Morales, some degree Correa in Ecuador, Chavez in Venezuela, came to power in a complete vacuum where there was a complete collapse of the old order, the old political structure, old political establishment parties, and a complete failure in terms of economics, a development model. Whereas Lula was elected in a country that had was quite complex and the political and economic structure were very vital and he had to balance certain interests and work within it. I mean, it would hard not to look at Brazil and think of it as an enormous success. I mean, a lot of people were touting Lula. The most critical way to think of Lula, his election in 2002, was all of these kind of World Bank folks and IMF folks, people like James Wolfensohn, getting behind him as a way of kind of trying to create this new institutionalism. By 2002, they admitted that neoliberalism, and in terms of pure markets, had become an unsustainable model of development, and they agreed that you needed some kind of institutionalism, some kind of social redistribution of the benefits of economic growth. And they looked to Chile, but Chile is only a country of 10 million people. So they had hoped Lula would do for Brazil what Chile was, but on a larger model, for a model for the third world. And on some level, he did that.
The Chile, not of Pinochet, but of social democratic
success. Yeah, but of the social democrats, right. And on some level, he did that. He definitely worked within the existing power structure. He didn't really challenge either, you know, the finance capital or certainly any of the kind of economic interests or media interests in Brazil. He distributed some of the benefits of Brazilian development in a much more equitable way through the enormously popular family Bolsa Familiar, this kind of direct cash transfer kind of thing that has been enormously successful. He instituted a more progressive taxation, but at the same time, nobody expected this when they were holding up Brazil as a way of saving neoliberalism, is that he really did preside over this diplomatic realignment of Brazil.
But I was going to say, he actually did improve the lot of millions of people as well.
Yeah, without doubt.
Without
he
a
lifted
doubt.
Tens of millions of people out of poverty.
And through this transfer mechanism?
Through that and through other...
Any kinds of economic development schemes that made a difference?
No, well, high commodity prices, which have less to do with anything that he did, and, you know, just the luck that he did.
And there have been some energy discoveries recently, too.
Right? Yeah, but those haven't really come online. Uh-huh. But yeah. He strengthened the state in the classic. I mean, I like to think of it as kind of social neoliberalism. I mean, it's not a big challenge to the old model. And in many ways, Lula really built on a lot of and nobody really gives the social democrats in Brazil this much credit, as much credit as they possibly deserve. But in some ways, he was building on the success and the institutionalism that his social democratic predecessors kind of laid out. He was just able to do it in a way that democratized the country, both politically, culturally, racially, and economically to a greater degree presided over that. A kind of much more social, what it's the model that, that Umala in Peru is holding up, so growth with social inclusion. But at the same time, to the degree that that was legitimating or stabilizing a certain model, he was also presiding over this this diplomatic realignment of the hemisphere.
You know. Meaning less orientation towards the U.S.
Yeah, on every level, on everything you could possibly imagine.
Which also you could be cynical and say means an aggrandizement of Brazilian power.
Well, I mean, I like to put it this way. I said you could always tell a rising hegemon because their interests and their ideals align. And that's the case of Brazil, where you could settle the declining hegemon like the U.S. because their interests are going one way and the ideals seem increasingly hollow and tinny. A perfect example of this is there are economic interests in Brazil that were threatened by the resource nationalism in Ecuador and Bolivia, lesser degree in Paraguay over hydroelectricity, but certainly over natural gas in Bolivia when Evo Morales nationalized hydrocarbons in Bolivia. Lula constantly defended those countries against his own interests. Now, it ultimately benefited them, right? He was able to kind of articulate a national interest against the much more destabilizing particular interests that Sao Paulo's energy needs, Sao Paulo, as the industrial center of Latin America needs Bolivian natural gas, and they certainly didn't like it when Evo Morales started doing what he was doing in Bolivia. But Lula was able to both defend those countries against private interests in Bolivia, in Brazil, while at the same time, which ultimately wound up benefiting those interests in Brazil.
So now, was that just an accident, or did he have some kind of long-term vision of what was going on?
Well, I think that there's people within his foreign policy team that have a vision of a grand America, a Latin America. I mean, this is a very particular Latin America thing. But Brazil never really saw itself as Latin America. It always saw itself as particular. It's, they speak Portuguese. They have a distinct history.
How much of a difference does that make, the Portuguese versus Spanish?
Well, I think it did matter for a while, but I think increasingly, and I think Brazil, not so much the language, but also a distinct history. They had a monarchy throughout a good chunk of the 19th century, so they have a less of a kind of republican tradition. They speak a different language. They are geographically in some ways isolated, but what you saw under this foreign policy team, people like Antonio Patriota and these other people who made up Lula's foreign policy team, was a much more Pan-American vision or Pan-Latin American vision. And it dovetailed quite nicely, again, with the more radical left, the more populist left, Hugo Chavez and Venezuela. And you see this often in WikiLeaks, where the U.S. is constantly trying to get the Bush administration. There's all of these great cables where especially when it was unclear what Lula was going to do or what the kind of defining essence of the Lula administration was by 2004, 2005, the Bush administration officials would be constantly talking to different people in the foreign policy team and they'd all agree, yes, Venezuela is a problem, yes, Venezuela is a problem. But you don't understand, Latin America has its own reality. They never argued with the United States for no reason, right? They were always constantly conceding to the U.S. as they were doing absolutely nothing to isolate Venezuela and actually working with Venezuela to create this kind of autonomous foreign policy vis-a-vis Washington.
So, how does this assertiveness on the part of Brazil and the increasing unity across Latin America, how's this playing in Washington?
It doesn't play well in Washington, right? I mean, it certainly didn't play well under the Bush administration. And for example, again, this is all thanks to WikiLeaks. For years, Brazil had convinced Washington that it was willing to put into place a kind of Patriot Act style legislation. This kind of, the U.S. was trying to get South America to kind of modernize its legal system in order to confront terrorism, which was much more preemptive, weakening habeas corpus, all of that stuff. Brazil constantly said, yes, we're doing this. And then there's a great WikiLeaks thing around 2006, 2007, when they realized that Brazil has no interest whatsoever in putting this into place. and a number of different issues. The Bush administration was very there was a lot of friction between between Lula and the Bush White House. When Obama was elected, there was all this talk of a reset. They were going to reset relations. They made much of the fact that they were both people of color. Lula was a trade unionist, a first for his country, not so much a person of color, but certainly an outsider. Obama was an African American, and you know they both had, you know, they both shared certain visions. You know, that obviously didn't happen because they immediately had falling out over a number of different issues, including including climate change talks. They have different positions on that. They had Honduras, the U.S.'s attempt to legitimize the coup in Honduras became a big flashpoint in Brazilian-U.S. relations. And then underwriting it all is the fact that the White House can't do anything to alleviate or make concessions to the overriding issue that Brazil cares about, and that's subsidies of the U.S. agro industry and tariffs. You know, the 37-cent tariff on ethanol, you know, the subsidy. You know, Brazil is constantly threatening to sue the United States and the world and the WTO. And certainly there's the inability to kind of jumpstart the free trade agreement of the Americas is largely almost exclusively over Brazil's opposition to, or you know, pointing out the gap that exists between the rhetoric of free trade and the reality of a highly protected agricultural sector in the United States.
We're listening to an interview with Greg Grandin, a professor of Latin American history at NYU. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with more from Greg Grandin.
It won't take long for the storm to pass. Let me in. Let me help you. Don't make me go away. This is the price we pay. Let me in. Let me in. Let me in. The light is gone. All the eyes are closing one by one. One by one.
That was some more of the Mekons, the band that has exclusive lock on today's musical segments on Behind the News, doing One by One. And now back to my interview with Greg Grandin, who is a professor of Latin American history at NYU, with his overview of the encouraging political developments in the southern part of our hemisphere. To a casual observer, it seems that the United States has been so obsessed with the Middle East over the last decade that it hasn't really been paying all that much attention to Latin America, and things are kind of slipping out of control. Is that a fair impression?
Yeah, I think that's I mean, it's always, you know, the chicken or egg question. What is it because they're not is Latin America slipping out of control because it wasn't paying attention? It started, I think, because there were structural changes in the global economy that allowed Latin America to have alternative sources of credit and capital. In China in particular is a huge thing, but also Russia, the Middle East. And so I think that there were things going on in Latin America that was weakening the region's dependence on the United States. There was also the political overreach of the Bush administration on a number of instances, particularly the 2002 coup against attempted coup against Chavez, which was in retrospect, it may not be as dramatic as the Bay of Pigs in terms of creating concentric circles of radicalization throughout the region, but it certainly led to this notion that that the United States wasn't committed to democracy, democratizing the region. I mean, if it was willing to support these coups and continually support these coups to anybody who they felt was a problem, and then I think that part of it is also. There's real divergences, and Latin America was against the Iraq War, and it was against the Iraq War in particular, and it was against the War on Terror more broadly, and it resisted and rebuffed efforts to kind of organize the region into a kind of, you know, the way to think about it is the Bush administration hoped to substitute the war on terror for what the Cold War used to do, a way of kind of marshaling the region behind U.S. leadership. And there are a number of particular instances where that failed. It failed in terms of the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. It failed in 2005 when Donald Rumsfeld tried to put on into place this kind of hemispheric security agenda. And he did this in Quito at a meeting of defense ministers where one defense minister after another said that terrorism is not our number one problem. We have inequality, poverty, environmental issues. So they were rebuffed along those lines. And then I think what you see is an increasing doubling down on countries like Colombia, countries like Peru until recently, countries like Central America, Guatemala, and Mexico. But that leaves the United States with what could be called a kind of Rump Monroe Doctrine, unable to kind of exert, and unable to administrate the hemisphere as a kind of unit the way it used to do, as a kind of single unit, and increasingly is kind of retrenching into an ever smaller and smaller periphery. And they just lost Peru. Colombia, even though Colombia has been the recipient of billions of dollars of U.S. aid, it's the new president, Santos, has exhibited an enormous amount of independence from Washington, tilting increasingly towards Brazil, if you think about it as a kind of, you know, which way countries are going to fall, if they're going to fall towards Washington or fall towards Brasilia. Santos, on a number of different issues, has basically bucked Washington's directives. Most recently, when Washington wanted to extradite a drug-running paramilitary, that Venezuela also wanted to extradite, and Santos sent the person to Venezuela, not to the U.S. It was a big slap in the face of Washington.
Speak with Greg Grandin of NYU. The clock is ticking. We still have several countries to hit up here in our rapid tour. But Bolivia, one of the things that interests me there, they just enshrined rights for Mother Earth in the Constitution. Yeah. At the same time, they're developing large natural gas deposits. What do you make of that?
It's the contradictions are heightening. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, it's what you have here is a kind of return to some form of the different forms of state developmentalism with all of the good and bad things that go with it. I think that compared to the old models of state developmentalism, what's kind of optimistic is that the relationship between, and the way I think, this is the way I think about it, in the old models of state developmentalism, the idea was to create some kind of alliance with a developmental, centralized political party and grassroots unions or peasant organizations that were supposed to be a counter or weaken these kind of entrenched sectors of the economy that are anti-democratic, that are unproductive. I think in some ways that model is in place now, but there's a lot more flexibility between the grassroots and the developmentalists, whereas,
well, that kind of developmental model you talked about could often degenerate into an elite that was protected and subsidized, that just sucked resources out,
exactly,
and generated a lot of poverty and repression.
And it did, and because the grassroots, the unions and peasants were vertically integrated, when certain elites turned or when corruption set in, the grassroots movements were so compromised with those parties, they didn't offer an effective check. I think one way to be optimistic about what's happening in countries like Bolivia and countries like Ecuador is there's a lot more flexibility between the base and the developmentalist parties. And so when these parties step too far out of, I mean, you see conflict in Ecuador between Correa and social movements over certain resource strategies, you know, what areas to develop, you know, where to, you know, how far to accelerate mining. Same thing in Bolivia, but you see these social movements much more willing to take on Correa or even take on Evo Morales or take on Chavez from the grassroots. There hasn't been this very tight corrupting verticalism between these developmental parties and these grassroots social movements. There's much more diversity. I mean, it's a kind of, in the 1990s, social scientists in Latin America, or wrote about Latin America, talked about new social movements and the diversity of new social movements organized around human rights, around gender, around race, around gay rights, around any number of different things. And I think what you're seeing now is that, the development of that and that diversity and that heterodoxy, and the return of a certain form of developmentalism. And those two things together have created a little bit more flexibility and a little bit more dynamic democracy than the old developmental model.
It sounds like if you've got the two things together, you can do something. Whereas if, you know, it's like this John Holloway model of not taking power.
Exactly.
You can't get very far with that.
Oh, exactly. That's exactly right. And what you see is the return of, you know, the return of thinking about the state, and thinking about state power and thinking about developmentalism, you know. I mean, there was a lot of crazy thinking in the 1990s and theorizing about, you know, whatever, social movements as an end into themselves and whatnot, you know, and how, you know, state power is corrupting. In some ways, it jived very nicely with neoliberalism, even though it supposedly came from the left. What's so fascinating about the current moment is, I think that there's these two things have developed an interesting synergy, and to use language from corporate America, and hopefully more dynamism than the old developmental model.
Now, is this because they're young, or is there something actually structurally different about it?
I think it's structurally different. I think that back in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, the grassroots organizing was around class and was around different forms of class, whether it be urban industrial unions or whether it be peasants and agrarian leagues and peasant organizations. And now, I think structurally, you just have a much more diverse social organizing around any number of issues. I mean, in Honduras, for example, Honduras is not one of the bright spots because the 2009 coup really did push, really did break that model. But that exactly was the model. You had Manuel Zelaya, a president who, for whatever reason, felt a slightly more inclined towards trying to create a more socially just society. And his social base was a diverse group of, it was unions, it was teachers, it was peasants, it was progressive religious folks, it was gay and lesbians, it was youth. I mean, it was a much more diverse flowering. And he was driven out of the country by this reaction. And that social movement has continued. And it's continued to exist, and they've managed to force his return, which happened last week. There's been compromises, and it wasn't the most optimal return. The people who carried out the coup are still in power and still enjoy impunity. But they have been a source of constant democratic mobilization that hasn't allowed the coup to consolidate itself.
And now, turning to the most hated figure in the region, Chavez in Venezuela. what's going on? I just happened to be looking at the inflation figures the other day.
Yeah.
Venezuela's got like a 26% inflation rate, which is like five or six times the regional average. Is this causing trouble?
I think it may be causing some trouble and discontent. I mean, there's going to be an election in 2012, and it depends if the opposition could get itself together and come up with a viable, credible candidate. I've long said that Venezuela that Chavez, out of the lot of them, is probably the most democratic, and I don't mean that as a personal virtue. I don't know what's in his heart. But there really is this enormous diversity on the ground that continue to support him and continue to do what it is they do in the barrios and the countryside.
What are they doing?
They're running community radio stations. They're holding marches. They're doing self-help things. They're creating community councils.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about developing a cooperative sector.
Yeah, no,
is that really happening?
I don't think an alternative society is emerging out of the ashes of the other one. That will be a kind of, I just think that he's given room on the ground for people to, to organize and to create political spaces and cultural spaces. I think there's been this remarkable democratization of the country, and we're going to see it with the rhetoric of the opposition, where they are probably, compared to where Venezuela was 10 years ago, neoliberalism, a lot of the kind of, you know, association of democracy with capitalism and free trade and privatization. The opposition has basically accepted the terms, the rhetorical terms of Chavismo, that democracy entails social democracy, that there has to be economic justice, that it's the state's responsibility to administer the national wealth in ways that benefit all. My take on Venezuela is a little particular. This is what I think. I think Chavez came to power with enormous rhetorical and electoral hegemony, but he didn't have institutional hegemony. The collapse of the old two-party system in Venezuela created a vacuum of power. Did he
have an organization when he came in?
Yes and no. I mean, there was a left in Venezuela. That was cobbled together from different tendencies. But he also had to make serious, in order, he didn't have an administrative cadre, you know, say that, you know, Sandinistas did, or, you know, a movement that comes to power through revolution, that comes to power over a long haul of having a clear vision. And there was still plenty of pockets of corruption the problem with Venezuela is not that Chavez had too much power, it's that he didn't have enough power. That's my take on it. And confronted with that, he's lurched here and there. But the fact of the matter is, you know, it's 12 years in. We're still waiting for the gulags to open. I don't know if you saw that article in the New York Times about the prison system.
Oh, yes. That was a strange piece. But the large cache of weapons over the drug deal.
No, and the disco and the kids and the children are in the pool.
I was thinking, what kind of state tolerates that? You know, a prison in which there's a large power base that is not the state.
It's great. It's not. It's not. I was joking around that it's. You know, it's not exactly what Foucault had in mind, but it's probably what Foucault wanted.
You got to have prisons.
It's more and less discipline and punish and more disco and punish.
Conjugal visits and barbecues. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to argue with. But it's been, 10, 12 years? So how would the average Venezuelan be able to answer the question, are you better off than you were a decade ago?
I think that they're better off. I mean, I think that, you know, it's hard to gauge these things, and I'm not an economist, and there's a lot of different debate. I mean, there are people... You know, credible organizations like the UN Development Program, UNDP, and the World Bank give Venezuela high marks on a lot of things. You know, I know there are detractors who said that those numbers are cooked. You know, the fact of the matter is that I think Chavez still has a lot of popularity, and I think even if polls put him at, you know, maybe just under 50%. I don't know exactly, but it's hard to gauge that as well. We're 12 years in, and enough of the population feels like their life has improved to the point where they don't want to go back to what there was. That there must have been significant advances. You know, a lot of the social programs, like Barrio Adentro, the medical program. I think on the one hand, it probably does continue to provide medical access to people who didn't have it in the past. On the other hand, I'm sure a degree of corruption and bureaucratization has set in that limits its true potential at the same way, right? So so I think there's a constant tendency among Chavez and his close circle of committed advisors that constantly create new parallel structures, right? You make another, parallel structure that works for a while, then the limits of that set in, then you do it again.
Well, you know, sometimes when I hear left purists criticize Chavez, I think, you know, it's really hard to govern.
Exactly. Well,
you don't really know what to do. You don't necessarily have the core of competent bureaucrats who can run things. You have to fight entrenched structures of power. You try it, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't have, especially if you don't have the, you know, and when you do have to rely on these, you know, these old pockets of corruption in the civil service and the military, all of them became Chavistas. The state just didn't have that much of an administrative reach.
I'm speaking with Greg Randin of NYU, I almost forgot. Worth saying something about Cuba. The post Fidel Cuba, apparent experimentation with market mechanisms, talk of democratization to some degree. What do you make of what's going on there?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I honestly, I haven't been following it that closely. I mean, because I mean, my understanding is that there were a number of different of announced reforms. Whether they'll be implemented is another story. I think that, you know, they have to walk a very fine line between to what degree do they really do throw hundreds of thousands of people into, you know, a tightly controlled market, but still one that maybe absolves the state of social welfare, and at the same time, you know, that doesn't become a tinderbox of political unrest if things don't work out.
Well, let's just step back and look at the whole picture. I mean, looking at the southern part of this hemisphere, I see quite a large percentage, I haven't done the numbers, but quite a large percentage of the population of Latin America now under fairly left of center and governments with some, looks like some serious and interesting and competent people in charge, and a lot of very interesting social movements that you talked about. I am habitually a pessimist, but you know, this looks pretty good. I mean, are good things happening in the Southern Hemisphere?
Yeah. I mean, I think the two main things that the left has done is, aside from whatever actual, aside from improving the life of millions of, if not tens of millions of people, I think one is that they've kind of seized the concept of democracy away from the neoliberals to redefine it in a more sustainable manner as social democracy. You know, this notion of democracy equaling unregulated capitalism is over in Latin America. And they have, the left in Latin America is also a continental-wide civil rights movement. And Latin America is an enormously unequal and exclusive society. And in Brazil, in Venezuela, and now in Peru, hopefully, what you've seen over the last couple of years is not just economic social justice movements, but ethnic and racial and gender justice movements that themselves don't make a distinction between economics and those other identities. You know, they see it all as one. And when you look at the world, it's hard.
Well, how can any materialist make a distinction?
Yeah, like that? And when you look at the world, it's hard to imagine another region that's governed by a majority of governments that are, you know, committed not to making a few people rich, but, you know, making the lives of poor people better. I mean, it's a classic left agenda: solidarity, equality.
But it also seems that although nationalism figures in a lot of these agendas to some degree, it also seems like a real serious internationalist regional movement where they're watching each other and learning from each other and deriving strength from each other. Is that right?
I mean, Latin American nationalism is always internationalist at the same time. It's deeply humanist and universalist. It's never been particular. I know there was a lot, like somebody like Amy Chua wrote that book World on Fire, worried about these ethnic movements in Bolivia and Ecuador as, you know, as somehow...
She should stick with parenting theory.
It was such a horrible book, but I think it captured a certain kind of way of thinking of these indigenous movements as somehow ethnic particular movements or extremists or fundamentalists. They're social democrats. I mean, they're the best bearers of the social democratic tradition. They believe in democracy as social democracy. And I think that nationalism in Latin America, one of the things that's remarkable about it is, you know, sure, I mean, there has been more nasty, there's certainly an authoritarian tradition in Latin America. There's certainly in the middle of the century flirtations with fascism. But for the most part, Latin American nationalism has always been deeply humanist and universalist at the same time.
But it seems that the virus has not yet caught on in Mexico.
No. Well, and I think that you can look geographically at the region. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about here is specifically South America. And when you get closer to the U.S.'s sphere of influence, Mexico, Central America, Colombia, until recently, you see a very different pattern. And I think they're very much aware of that. When they talk, when Lula and Chavez, they talk about South America more than they talk about Latin America. I think they're very aware of the limits of the influence of a lot of these changes. And you saw it very clearly with the Honduran coup. Brazil and Venezuela held back a little bit and let Brazil take the lead on demanding a restoration of democracy in Honduras. But they couldn't do it. But they could save democracy in Bolivia in 2008 when the right tried to destabilize Evo Morales. They could save democracy last year in Ecuador when certain sectors of the establishment tried to destabilize Correa, but they couldn't do it in Honduras. And I think it's very clear, you know, you could think of it, you know, this return to a certain geographic division of the hemisphere, of the Western hemisphere, between a Central America and a Mexico that's fully within and locked in through Central American free trade agreements, through the North American free trade agreement, and the South American part of the hemisphere that has much more room to maneuver.
We've been listening to Greg Grandin. Greg teaches Latin American history at NYU and is the author of Empire's Workshop, a book about how the U.S. learned the imperial trade in the southern part of our hemisphere, and Fordlandia, about Henry Ford's giant scheme to build a factory in the jungles of Brazil. Apologies for that bit of screaming kid in the last few seconds of the interview, but that's the risk of doing on-site instead of a hermetically sealed studio. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with one more from the Mekons, featuring the great and glorious Sally Timms, a ghost of American astronauts, which is something of a reflection on Yankee imperialism. Till next week, bye! Go!